This is Faster Forward from Northern Trust Asset Servicing, where we explore stories, insights, and lessons learned from leaders and innovators that are driving transformation across their industries.
This is Faster Forward from Northern Trust Asset Servicing. In this podcast, we explore stories, insights, and lessons learned from leaders and innovators who are driving transformation across their industries. I'm Patrice Sikora, and joining Faster Forward again today is Carl Tannenbaum, Chief Economist at Northern Trust. We are really excited to have Carl on the podcast to share his thoughts on the factors that are driving recent trends, potential headwinds to be aware of, and expectations for the remainder of 2024. So, Carl, it really is good to have you back on the podcast. For our audience who may have missed your first episode in January of 2023, that was a long time ago, can you please provide a quick summary of your background and your role at Northern Trust?
Firstly, Patrice, glad to be back with you. I hadn't realized it had been so long, and now that I do, I guess I had assumed that the first attempt was so poor that I was no longer on the list of invited guests. But for those who didn't remember the first one, I do serve as the organization's chief economist. Among my responsibilities is to accept blame for anything wrong that goes on with the markets or our client portfolios. But more fundamentally, we watch the landscape for economic developments. We try and connect the dots amongst sometimes conflicting information to get a clearer picture, produce a forecast. We also write good weekly commentary, at least we think it's good, that you can access on northerntrust.com. And we are out and about quite a lot seeing our clients, and I've been doing a lot of that even so far this year.
Well, I must say, if you're getting blamed for the market's performance, you should be in seventh heaven right now. I mean, a year ago, forecasters were saying, oh no, recession is coming. Hello, surprise.
Patrice, one thing that that you have to realize is that economists are easily blamed, but infrequently credited. So I have one-way risk when it comes to the markets. The improvement in asset prices is always attributable to the skill of our portfolio managers and not to my forecasts.
All right. Well, why do you think the economy is doing so well?
Well, since we last got together, it is an understatement to say that the U.S. economy, anyway, has outdone our expectations, especially in the second half of last year when we thought that activity would be tapering off in the wake of much higher interest rates. We instead continued to sprint ahead. The cumulative growth rate annualized in the latter half of 2023 was well over 3%. The tracking for the first quarter of this year is well over 2%, so a long way from the recession that many thought were possible by this time in the business cycle. So it's been a very pleasant set of surprises.
Inflation. Talk to me about that. It's been on the decline. The economy, though, has been doing very well, as you mentioned. But that seems to be kind of an anomaly. What happened here?
Well, the understanding of how inflation arises and recedes is one that is still something that economists are struggling to understand completely. But during this cycle, Patrice, I think we have a much clearer picture of what has happened and will happen than we had when we last visited. When the pandemic hit, it created a couple of major supply shocks that affected the world economy and the evolution of prices. The first, of course, was the supply chain disruptions that centered on China's supply of goods to Western countries. The pandemic obviously fouled their ability to both produce and transport those materials, which became scarce, and their prices as a result went up very, very substantially. Happily, supply chain problems, at least in the Far East, have healed. As we visit today, we are watching a couple of spots in the Middle East. There are substantial shipments that go back and forth between China and Western Europe that would normally transition through the Red Sea. A lot of that shipping has been rerouted under the Cape of Good Hope, makes it more secure, but also a little bit more expensive. And then, of course, very recently, we had the unfortunate incident with the container ship that ran into the Francis Scott Key Bridge outside the Port of Baltimore, which is a very large East Coast port. We don't think that's going to have the same impact that we saw during the pandemic, but obviously it is a source of potential disruption. The second supply shock, Patrice, was to the labor markets, and here things get a little bit more subtle. Sadly, we lost working women and men during the pandemic. Others who have survived have what we call long COVID. Those are lingering cognitive or respiratory limitations that prevent them from working full-time or at all. Subtly, too, we had to close the borders to legal immigration for a period of about 18 months, which limited the supply of new workers that come into certain industries and put pressure on the prices of those services. And so now, on the other side of the mountain, we are beginning to see a healing in that supply shock as well. Entrants to the labor market have soared. A recent piece by the Brookings Institute estimated that last year we welcomed 3 million newcomers to the United States, much higher than we had previously suspected. Many of those, to be sure, are awaiting adjudication of their desire to stay in this country. But while they wait, they are working. They are producing output. They are paying taxes. And they are providing relief to areas of the labor market that had been stressed. So as the supplies of goods and people normalizes, that has created a downdraft in inflation. And so as we visit today, we are within shouting distance, I think, of that price stability that we've been trying to regain since 2020.
Well, the Fed would certainly be happy to hear what you just said. The market's really been watching what they've been doing. They were talking, I believe it was three cuts this year, but they've just said, maybe we're going to hold off still. And yet the market said, that's okay. What do you think is going to be the path of the Fed going forward? What will determine the timing and pace of any easing?
Are you trying to get me to go on record with a forecast and a date in the same sentence?
And it's only the Fed. Come on, Carl.
All right. Well, we'll make the attempt. First, let me bring everybody current on what's happened to this point. The Federal Reserve, when we last visited, was still raising interest rates, trying to limit demand by increasing the cost of borrowing, and in so doing, to bring down the price level. What they have found is that the price level is curing, in some cases on its own, because of the supply side of the economy. And late last year, the Fed, among other central banks, concluded that further interest rate increases were no longer necessary. That got the market focused, perhaps initially somewhat optimistically, that a pivot was close at hand and would proceed fairly quickly. As recently as last January, the market was set up for six or even seven reductions in interest rates during the course of 2024, with the first move to come at the March meeting. Well, obviously, that meeting has taken place, and not only were rates not cut, but the guidance that we got from the Federal Reserve was that they're preferring to wait just a little bit longer. Inflation has come down, but the group wants to be trebly assured that it will stay there. There remain a couple of outstanding spots in the inflation outlook that they're less comfortable with. One of them is the category on which we spend most of our monthly budgets, which is shelter. The value of houses continues to go up. Rental rates in many parts of the country are still escalating at a brisk pace. And those may not recede in the way that we previously had hoped for the reason that I just mentioned. When you have 3 million people who have come into the country and need places to live, that is not a factor that's going to lower rents. So the Fed is watching that very intently, as well as the costs of some services. In addition, I think the Fed feels the need to a certain degree to lean against very stimulative policy on the other side of the capital. One of the things that has distinguished American economic performance from that in Europe and other places is that the programs initiated by the Congress and the White House over the last year and a half have been large and substantial. Things like the Inflation Reduction Act, which is ill-named. It's really having to do more with energy transition. The CHIPS Act, which aims to make us more self-sufficient in the production of microcircuitry. And then the Infrastructure Bill, which covers a lot more than roads and bridges and extends to things like broadband, has put a lot of money out into the economy. We do have a big budget deficit. We finally got a full year budget in place, Patrice, and it's a good thing. We're only 6 months into the fiscal year. But as the Fed looks at all of that money continuing into the economy, it does raise the risk that inflation might be persistently high. And so I think the recipe we have here is for higher for a little bit longer in terms of interest rates. Our own forecast is that they will reduce rates for the first time this coming June. And we still anticipate that three further movements in rates will come during the balance of 2024. But obviously, incoming data may steer that path for us.
You mentioned Congress, you mentioned a budget. I'm thinking presidential elections this year. Do you believe, or in your opinion, is there any chance that that will impact the markets, or will the market simply say, go do your thing, we're focused on the world?
Patrice, it's my policy not to discuss the election until 2 months before the balloting actually takes place. That is a policy that I've had a hard time enforcing. In fact, I believe it's been 5 or 6 months that I've been getting persistent questions about how the balloting might turn out. Let me offer a few thoughts to our listeners. First, please focus on policies and not personalities, as hard as that might be to do. The markets, for better or worse, are less interested in some of the more salacious details or controversial ones that end up in the courts, and they really want to know what either candidate will do for the economy or to the economy. Note also that the market takes a very long-term view. So they're looking not just at the next administration, but potentially to the tone of policy that goes on long before the next president ends their terms. Next, it's very important to focus not just on the executive branch, but both houses of Congress are up for grabs. The margins are very slim currently and will likely remain that way. Major policy change would only result from a single party that gains control of both the White House and both houses of Congress. At this juncture, that seems unlikely, but there are many months to the balloting. And then finally, the areas that the market is most concerned on are ones that you could easily anticipate. What will be the tone towards trade, regulation, immigration, and fostering healthy levels of innovation and investment here in the United States? It's those policy positions that we should pay close attention to as we evaluate how the 2024 balloting will affect the economy and the markets.
Carl, thank you for that. Very insightful. And now, you were recently in Europe meeting with clients. What insights did you gain there? What are people talking about?
At the outset, Patrice, I would tell you that no matter how hard we've tried in the United States, the bakeries in Europe are still a lot better than we have here at home.
I go with you on that. Yes.
I almost feel like I should, you know, work while walking on a treadmill after all of those croissants that I consumed during the two-week interval. But while the breads and the pastries may be superior, economic performance has not been. As I began to highlight, Europe, by contrast to the United States, stopped stimulating its economies after the pandemic was safely into the past and have been engaged more in what we refer to as austerity to try and keep their budget deficits under control. Both the United Kingdom and the continent of Europe have formal or informal guidelines that annual shortfalls not exceed 3% of gross domestic product, which is just the value of all the goods and services that's made in an economy. In order to achieve that level, they've had to accommodate much higher interest rates, which are requiring more tax revenues to satisfy. They are also under pressure to make long-term investments in additional security with the threats on their eastern frontier, digital transformation, energy transition, all of the above. And so finding opportunities to stimulate their economies is a lot more difficult, and their performance shows it to a certain degree. I certainly was subjected to a certain amount of envy while I was there. Our clients wondered how it is that the United States can seemingly issue debt without limit, while Europe is much more limited. And I noted that I share their concern about whether there are limits on our ability to borrow and where those are. Because once you pass them, Patrice, it's very difficult to get back on sides with investors.
Mm-hmm. Take us further east. Fill us in on China and Japan. What's the latest there?
A classic good news, bad news situation. Let's start with the good news. Japan, after struggling for three decades, finally seems to have reestablished normal levels of inflation in their economy. One of the last holdouts was the level of wages that some of the big companies pay to their employees in Japan, which are the subject of wage negotiations. When the economy was in deflation, a state when prices are actually falling, companies were loath to pass along raises to their employees because they were earning less and less on the products that they sold. But the key to getting the cycle moving in a positive direction is to increase incomes, increase demand, which allow for increased pricing power and normal levels of inflation. And we're beginning to see those in Japan for the first time since 1990. The tone around Japan is reflected in the fact that the Nikkei 225, their major equity index, hit a new high recently for the first time in 34 years. Japan is viewed as a viable option for trading relative to China. It's friendly with the West. It is less likely to be disrupted from a supply chain perspective, a good place into which to invest. And while Japan still has some structural challenges, the tone around it has gotten a lot better. On the other side is China, which is struggling with a long list of maladies that will be very difficult to cure. China's economic growth was reported at 5%, although many suspect that the level of artifice involved in the measurement has been increasing. Their export markets have been limited as countries and companies look for contingencies or alternatives to Chinese production that might be interrupted for any number of reasons. In addition, there are those who are playing scenarios out where sanctions are levied against China or additional trade restrictions are levied against China that would recommend sourcing from other places. So Chinese exports are not growing nearly as quickly. They have a property crisis that is many times larger than we dealt with in the United States in 2008. They have debt problems at the national and local levels, and they have the beginnings of the deflation, which so afflicted Japan for so many years. One of the things that I've noted is that the Chinese have one advantage over the Japanese in avoiding a similar fate, and that is learning from the Japanese experience. Scholars, including Ben Bernanke, the former chair of the Federal Reserve and Nobel laureate, have pointed out that when a country is at risk of going into depression and deflation, the policy prescription is to be very aggressive, large-scale stimulus programs sustained for long periods of time to avoid a negative mindset setting in. Unfortunately, China had a major economic policy meeting in March, the two sessions they called it, and the measures proposed were incremental and not monumental. And unless China is able to ramp up its addressing of its myriad challenges, it will not be the attractive market that it has been for so many years.
Mm. In one of your recent videos for Northern Trust, Carl, you suggested geopolitical risk should be a major consideration for investors. Tell us why you feel that way, and how are you attempting to address this at the bank?
One only has to look at the headlines or the walls of worry that many of us keep to conclude that the world is a more unsecure place than it was, let's say, 10 or 15 years ago. Patrice, I have a theory as to why that is.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning in the early 1980s, globalization was an anthem that was sung in a number of world capitals. The notion of economic cooperation as a path towards higher standards of living and better economic achievement was embraced. We signed a lot of new trade agreements during the decades that followed. We did see both market performance and economic performance that far outdid what we saw, let's say, in the 1970s. And along with that, economic cooperation begot a lot of diplomatic cooperation. High-minded folks began calling this a new global order, under which tail events were much less likely because somehow they would be discouraged from occurring, and when they did arise, they would be dealt with swiftly. But beginning in 2008, the crisis, which illustrated the downsides of some of the economic and market cooperation, countries began turning inward, both economically and diplomatically. The number of trade restrictions in place today is many times what we had back then, and measures of geopolitical uncertainty have grown in concert. While the two wars that we have underway at the moment have roots that go back centuries or even millennia, the fact that they're occurring now, I believe, is attributable in part to the absence of global orders or policing that gave space for rogue actors to step forward. I wish I could guarantee that we would see no further such incursions, but the landscape does seem conducive to having those kinds of things happen. We can never predict those clearly, but I suppose the best way of dealing with them is to prepare for the worst. So what we're doing at the bank, and I know that a number of others are, is taking a tail event and studying it, creating a set of circumstances that would then lead to reactions and then planning the best way to deal with them, from everything from a physical security to an investment perspective, and creating playbooks and occasionally preventative actions or insurance steps that you can take so that if the worst case comes, you're best prepared for it.
Well, those are some very sobering thoughts, Carl, but thank you so much for them. And thank you for joining us today. This has been an excellent and very informative discussion. I learned a lot, and I'm confident our listeners did too. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to Faster Forward from Northern Trust Asset Servicing.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Subscribe to Faster Forward from your favorite podcast app to be automatically notified of new episodes. This audio podcast is being provided for informational and educational purposes only and is not meant to be taken as investment advice or a recommendation of any specific investment product or strategy. The information does not take your financial situation, investment objective, or risk tolerance into consideration. Listeners, including professionals, should under no circumstances rely upon this information as a substitute for their own research or for obtaining specific legal, investment, accounting, or tax advice from their own counsel. Northern Trust Corporation, Head Office 50 South LaSalle Street, Chicago, Illinois, 60603. USA Incorporated with limited liability in the U.S.